In 1942, the U.S. government issued evacuation notices to all persons of Japanese ancestry. More than 110,000 Japanese Americans were forced out of their homes and into camps. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Neil Nakadati. He's just published a new memoir, Looking After Minidoka. We'll talk about his family history, the struggles his Japanese grandparents faced when they immigrated to the United States, a country that did not welcome them with open arms, and the time his family spent incarcerated in the internment camp called Minidoka. We'll also talk about the legacy of those camps. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In the wake of Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government incarcerated more than 110,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps. Property was lost and lives were, at the very least, turned upside down and put on hold for years. Of course, some lives were lost as well. But this action came after decades of legal discrimination against immigrants from Japan and China. This hour, I'll talk with Neil Nakadati. He is the grandson of immigrants from Japan and has just published a new memoir, Looking After Minidoka. He's also an emeritus professor of English at Iowa State University. Hello, Neil.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go back to when your two grandfathers were the first people in your family to come to the United States. When did they come and what brought them here?
My mother's father came right in 1900. My father's father came a few years after that. My mother's father came from Wakayama Ken Prefecture, which is on the Sea of Japan, and my dad's father came from Yamanashi Ken, which is northwest of Tokyo and is an agricultural prefecture. And of course, as it turns out now, is the sister state of Iowa.
Why? Then let's talk about your mother's father first. Why did he come to the U.S.?
He came partly because he was a younger son, and this didn't put him in a particularly good position within the family structure in Japanese culture. So he felt, as so many immigrants did, that his best chance to get ahead in the world was to come to America. And, of course, it had been touted by many as the place to go if you wanted to move forward. And he came as what we would call a contract laborer, although I think when he wrote down what he was, he said he was a farmer. And that was because farming in Japan and in the United States was considered to be a more prestigious line of work.
Now, your father's father was not a younger son. He was the eldest child in his family.
He was the eldest of 10. And he had four brothers, and his obligation within the family was to help promote the family fortunes and eventually be the one who took care of their parents in their old age. And with that large a family, I think he felt that his best chance of fulfilling his responsibilities would be to come to the United States, make a good living, send money back to Japan, and hope that that would be that he'd be a success in that way.
Now, at the time that these two men came to the United States, yes, this was the land of opportunity, and there was certainly work to do. They came to the West Coast of the United States, as many Japanese immigrants did. But what kind of opportunities did they really have here?
Well, it's useful to remember that they came within living memory of when there was slavery in the United States, which, of course, ended with the Civil War. But the United States, the American economy was still always looking for cheap labor. So you couldn't have slaves, but you would try to find the cheapest possible labor. And often it was referred to as cheap foreign labor. And we know the story of the Chinese being recruited to come and work on the railroads. And by the same token, the Irish worked on the railroads coming from the East Coast. And that was the context in which they came to the United States. What the U.S. wanted, what America wanted, was labor. And if all the better if it was labor that would come here, work for a while, and then go back to whatever country they came from.
And in that way, the structure of communities in the United States and even the laws in the United States were written in such a way as to not make staying here that attractive to these immigrants, right?
That's right. That's right. For example, the wages were so low that a person could not really that many of the immigrants couldn't really get ahead. They could survive, but their dreams of moving ahead in the world or sending money back to the old country were very hit and miss at that time. My father's father was fortunate in that he was able to do that, but it wasn't necessarily the most common outcome. There were a lot of local, state, and federal laws at the time that made it very difficult for immigrants from Asia to get a good foothold in the United States.
Well, and you fill two full pages of your book just giving us a brief outline of some of these many laws that made life so difficult for your grandparents. And I am struck even by the fact that after the Civil War, I mean, in 1790, federal law limited citizenship to free white persons. But after the Civil War in 1875, Congress stipulates that naturalization law applies only to free white persons and to aliens of African nativity and to persons of African descent. And these laws go on to make it impossible, really impossible, for your grandparents to become citizens of the United States.
That's right. And that didn't change until I believe it was 1952.
1952.
Yes. So that would be, 7 years after the end of World War II, when they were finally able, after living in the United States for all of their adult lives, 40, 50 years, it wasn't until then that they were able to become citizens. And that's exactly what my mother's parents finally did. And I got to help them study for the citizenship exam.
They also were prohibited from buying homes. It was against the law for them to intermarry. Although, as you point out, your grandparents didn't have a desire to marry outside of the Japanese culture.
There were many restrictions on their lives, and they started families eventually, and with that immigrant generation, they were particularly still focused on the culture they came from, and so they were normally quite happy finding a partner who also came from that culture. There were many restrictions in the United States to establishing an economic base, establishing a family, as you said, purchasing property. In many jurisdictions, Japanese were not allowed to buy land. And so you can imagine what it would be like if you were a farmer and came to the U.S. and had dreams of having your own farm, and then finding out that the state of California, say, prohibited you from doing that.
What brought your grandmothers to the United States? Because they did not come on their own.
They did not. They were they came after my grandfathers, and it's important to remember that when the Japanese first started to come to the United States, it was primarily men. It was overwhelmingly men. Well over 90% of the immigrants were men, because that's who was wanted to work in the fields, in the mines, in the lumber camps, and canneries, and so on. And wives and families would just, in effect, get in the way of using that immigrant labor. So it wasn't until my grandfathers had been in the United States for over a decade that they were able to get married. And in both cases, the marriages were arranged through their families in Japan. And when my mother's mother came to the United States, she was a picture bride. And the first time my grandfather saw her, the first time she saw him, was when she got off the boat in, I believe it was in Seattle. And the date of that's typically taken as the date of their marriage is the date when the ship landed. My father's mother was also an arranged marriage, but in his case, my grandfather, my dad's dad, actually went back to Japan and brought her back himself.
And in their case, they both wanted to make sure that they met before everything was decided.
I think,
right?
in knowing what I know about both of them, they both would have wanted not to be married without having at least first met and perhaps had a few conversations in Japan, and then they came to the United States on the same ship together.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Neil Nakadati. His new memoir is called Looking After Minidoka, an American memoir. He writes about his family, his grandparents immigrating to the United States from Japan, and about the time that his family, including a very young Neil himself, spent in a Japanese internment camp, or an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Neil Nakadati. He has written a new memoir called Looking After Minidoka, an American memoir. It's about his family. His grandparents came to the United States from Japan. And, of course, his parents are Americans. They were born in this country, as was he and his generation of children. But his family also was incarcerated at an internment camp during World War II for Japanese and Japanese Americans. We'll talk about that more in just a few minutes. Neil, the book is a mixture of prose and poetry, and I gather that a lot of the poetry was written well before you sat down to write this memoir. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, my most successful early attempts to try to write about one or another aspect of this larger story, my first successful efforts were with poems. And I can't tell you exactly why that was the case, except that a poem is a nice, compact distillation of a particular time, a particular moment, a particular feeling. And I was able to get a handle on the time, the feeling, and so on, in some of those poems, and that gave me some I guess you'd say, some traction for writing the rest.
Well, it strikes me as I read the book that it took you a very, very long time to put all these pieces of the puzzle together. I mean, there were things that your parents just didn't want to ever tell you or just neglected to tell you over the years. And you had to do a lot of research to try to piece this whole narrative together.
Yes, that's the case. I mentioned we were talking about the poems. Well, I would write a poem and then I'd say, well, you know, there's more that I need to know about one or another aspect of this particular time. And I had to do research on it because either I hadn't been there in the case of my grandparents, or I had been so young when certain things happened that I needed to look things up. It was a really interesting experience in research of a very different kind from what any research I'd done earlier. But I found it fascinating. I'd often get sidetracked because I was discovering things that were just fascinating to me as a researcher, as well as someone who was, in a way, part of the story.
Would you read one of the poems that made it into the book for us? This is Aboard the Amtrak Cascade.
I'd love to. This is a poem, one of my earlier poems. It was written in 1999, and it was prompted by a trip I took on the Amtrak from Portland to Seattle. And in it, I refer to my mother's father, the one who worked on the railroad as a laborer. And at the end, I allude to the fact that he worked on the railroad and I ended up being able to go to college. And in fact, in my case, I went to Stanford University in California. So here's Aboard the Amtrak Cascade, Portland to Seattle, via Vancouver, Kelso, Longview, Centralia, Olympia, Lacey, and Tacoma. Tie, spike, and rail, you laid this track, Grandpa, in the immigrant obscurity of a nickel-an-hour Japanese extra gang, a young man living out recruiter's lies in endless railroad labor. Now it's mile a minute on a train loaded down with urban khaki tourists and cell phone commuters, our right of way marked by cable spools, graffiti scrawls, treadless tires, sawmill scrap, cordwood-laden gravel cars, filmy plastic snagged on bushes, abandoned shopping carts. Track repairmen in shiny hard hats drive bright yellow machines and wave. Beyond in shadow, I see the not yet great Northwest you found, rhododendron, cedar, blackberry, fern, and moss, muddy footing, bigotry, stoop labor, and a Wakayama village boy laying rail back when horsepower really meant horses and manpower meant exhaustion. Rousted at dawn into a dark mist, the drab seepage of Oregon winter, you ate strange food and asked tired muscles to recall their pain, to work more than one honest shift for every college class I would sit through under palms and Spanish tile, and for the half dozen I missed in those ignorant years of learning when the California morning came too soon.
That's Neil Nakadati. He's reading from a poem that appears in his new memoir, Looking After Minidoka, an American Memoir. Let's talk about your father and your mother. They, of course, were born in the United States, so they were American citizens in spite of all of the discriminatory laws that were in place in the United States at the time that they were born. And let's talk first about your father. He was an eldest son. What was his family life like?
His family life was very much dominated by two very strong willed parents. His father was very hard-driving, as it turned out, businessman who went from being a traveling salesman to being an office manager. And his mother had had some education in Japan to the extent that she was able to teach. So she had gone to what at that time would have been what we would have called a normal school. And so there was a great emphasis on working hard, not complaining, and getting an education. And that's the home that he grew up in with, along with his younger brother. It had everything to do with his lifelong push to excel at anything he did, whether it was as a lifeguard in the Boy Scouts, later in the Army, and as a doctor. So that was his background. And he always felt that as an American of Japanese ancestry, the door was wide open to him to achieve anything he wanted. So in his head was the American dream of making anything of your life that you were willing to work hard for.
Let's talk about your mother. And she was one of two sisters. And the life for women, of course, at that time was very different than life for men, for girls, than boys. But also because she was raised straddling these two cultures.
My mother and my aunt were both very bright. And it was a shame that neither of them got to go to college. And that was partly due to the Great Depression. But as they were growing up, they were living in two cultures, the public culture of, say, public education, and the home culture of their Japanese-born parents. So at home, they spoke Japanese, and all of their interactions with their parents were typical of the interactions of within Japanese families rather than American families. And I'm generalizing here, but that would be the way I would describe it. They when they went to public school, they spoke English. They were in the classroom with Chinese American students, white students from the same neighborhood. There was an African American student in their school, and so it was a very different atmosphere outside of the home. One of the things I learned about the lives of my mother and my aunt was the way that they became interpreters and translators for their parents with regard to American society, because, of course, they grew up bilingual and could read and write and speak both languages.
The sisters also had some really remarkable opportunities come their way. And first Fumi, the older sister, and then your mother, they both served as nannies. Can you tell me a little bit about their experiences?
Yes. It was interesting the way that came about. The Japanese consul, a man named Nakamura, the consul from Japan in Portland, he and his wife had a tea for the young Japanese American, the Nisei women, the American-born Japanese in Portland, and they all thought this was just quite nice and a wonderful gesture, and so on. And my mother and my aunt went to this. But what became clear was that it was a kind of a way to get introduced to a large number of young women, one of whom would be chosen to be the nanny for the two children of the consul. And as it turned out, my aunt, who was 2 years older than my mother, my aunt was the one they selected as being the most promising nanny. That went well, except that within a year or so, my aunt got engaged and then got married, and they had to find a new nanny. And they said, well, we like your sister too, so would she be willing to be the new nanny? And that, so my mother became the second nanny for the children. And she enjoyed it, and I think that was her first experience being a teacher. And she never went to college and got a teaching credential. But I think she started teaching at that time.
Your grandmother was concerned about your mother in many ways because she did not marry as young as she felt that she should.
That's true. I think that this is a good example of my mother having to kind of negotiate, if that's the right word, between two cultures. And even among non-Japanese in the United States at that time, women, didn't wait until their late 20s to get married.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother kept – my mother had in her head that she would not be part of an arranged marriage, as her mother had been. She would get married to the person she wanted to get married to, and they would, I don't know how to say it, they would get married because they were in love with each other. So she had a very Western notion of male-female relationships. And she actually turned down at least two proposals from men who were perfectly nice guys, but men that she didn't have any particular feeling for, and she just held out and eventually, of course, married my dad.
How did they meet?
They were introduced by some family friends who were not Japanese, who knew both of them separately, and felt that they might be a good match. So I guess in that sense there was a kind of matchmaking, but in the American sense that they were just introduced to each other with the idea that maybe something would click. And as it turned out, something did click.
Tell me, your parents were not yet married when Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese. Your dad had gone on to medical school, and he had become a doctor, right?
Yes, that's right. He'd graduated, I believe, in 1939 from the University of Oregon Med School.
So when Pearl Harbor happened, of course, this was a huge shock to everyone in the United States. When did your dad first have an experience that made him think it could affect him and his career because he was Japanese American?
Well, one of the important moments in his career was when he graduated and then found it difficult to get an internship, which would, of course, be followed by a residency on the West Coast. And so he kept applying for internships farther away, and he ended up actually in Indiana, in East Chicago, Indiana. And so that was an interesting moment for him to find that even though he had done quite well in medical school, he was one of a group that wasn't necessarily welcomed into the culture, the profession of medicine, the way it was working at that time. So he ended up in the Midwest, and then for his residency, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, he was doing a residency in Detroit, Michigan.
And he got a call from the FBI, right?
He did. He was sleeping in the in the dorm or the for the residence, and he was awakened by the hospital administrator, and he said, "There are two fellows from the FBI who want to talk to you." Now, this is December 8th, right the day after Pearl Harbor.
So it only took a day.
It only took a day, and I think they already had been alerted, the FBI had been alerted to sort of keep know where Japanese Americans lived, as we say. And so there they were, and the hospital administrator said, "They want to talk to you," and I told them that they could use my office. So my dad went down, and they introduced themselves and as FBI agents, and one of them said, "Well, we have to talk to you, and you probably know why." And my dad said, "Well, yes." And then they said, "But we already know a lot about you. In fact, we probably know about as much as we need to know about you." Now, for most of us, this would be kind of frightening to know that they'd already got a folder with our names in it.
Right.
But the FBI agent said, "Well, turns out that one of our agents in our Detroit office, a guy named Jim Kirby, was in the Boy Scouts with you and remembers you as an Eagle Scout from Troop 66 in Portland, Oregon."
Wow. And that we'll talk more about that in just a moment. I'm talking with Neil Nakadati. His memoir is Looking After Minidoka. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking today with Neil Nakadati, who is an emeritus professor of English at Iowa State University and the author of a new memoir called Looking After Minidoka, about his family history and his family's experience being incarcerated in an internment camp during World War II for Japanese and Japanese Americans. And so your father was in many ways cleared in the eyes of the FBI because he was an Eagle Scout, and there were people who were willing to vouch for him. So he is a doctor, a Japanese-American doctor. Your mother's family, however, was not so fortunate. So when that evacuation notice came, your mother's family had to leave their property, had to sell their things almost overnight. And this was in early 1942, right?
That's right. It was the spring of 42. My grandparents had finally gotten to the place where they were able to operate a hotel. They didn't own the hotel building, but they were the operators of it. And they owned a lot of the furnishings in the hotel, the lamps and the beds and things like that. And but when the evacuation order came, and they had 1 week to liquidate all of their assets, and of course, they lost a lot of money because the buyers in that kind of a situation know that you don't have time to bargain, and the market is suddenly flooded with the same kinds of assets: people selling beds and lamps and so on, who live in rented houses or in other hotels. So they had to move out very quickly and ended up in Idaho.
Your mother went with them. Your aunt Fumi did not.
Fumi, by coincidence, she was married and had two children, my cousins, who are slightly older than I am. And she contracted tuberculosis, so she had to go into a TB hospital. And but because the evacuation order stipulated all persons of Japanese ancestry, the only exceptions were people like my aunt who had a communicable disease, but that meant my cousins and their father and my grandparents and my mother had to go into the camp, and that's what happened. So as it turned out, my aunt was in the hospital in Portland for the entire time and never was in the camp, but by the same token, she didn't get to see her daughters for 2.5 years.
And her marriage crumbled.
So, and that's a reminder that any of the things that might normally happen, even without an incarceration, even without a war, those things may happen anyway, and everything is made doubly difficult by the fact that you're trying to deal with the problem in the midst of other kinds of disruption.
Would you read for us just a little bit? You went much later in life, went back looking for this camp, trying to see what you could see of this camp. And you talked to a woman in the summer of 2001 who had some memories of the camp. Could you read that for us?
Yes. This woman's name was Thelma Stone. And I just stopped at her house on an impulse. There was a sprinkler in the front yard going, and so I knew someone was home. And this was in Eden, Idaho, which is a very small town near where the camp was. I had first met Thelma Stone during my brief visit in the summer of 2001. 2 years later, her sprinklers were still greening up the front of her trailer home, and she looked as she had before, a short, sturdy woman with trimmed white hair, combed back in just-washed, no-fuss fashion, a Sunday white flower-sprinkled shirt and fresh jeans, and a lifetime of wrinkles. Thelma had memories of her husband, her siblings, and a paralyzed son who'd been in a car wreck. And she, too, recalled the building of Minidoka. Constructed overnight in the desert, the camp was pretty much responsible for ending local unemployment and the area's experience of the Great Depression. "My dad was named Charlie Crawford," she said. "The company he worked for was hired to build the camp. He helped build that place." And then she added, "He'd come home. I wasn't but 12 years old, and he'd tell my mother, he'd say, 'I feel sorry for those people. It's just a dust hole out there.'"
And it was.
It was just a dust hole. And the people who were in the camps uniformly remember how dusty those locations were and how difficult it was to keep the dust out of the living quarters. Out of any of the buildings, because they were basically uninsulated and they just had black tar paper on the outside, and the dust came through the walls, through the ceilings, up through the floorboards, and they all remembered the dust.
And a lot of it wasn't even finished being built when they were moved there, right?
That's right. The Minidoka camp, in particular, was still being finished, and the last barbed wire went up while the people were in the camp. They got to watch the wire, the fences go up and surround them.
Your mother was there with her parents. She was doing a lot of the care for her nieces, your cousins, as well. And your father, they had been dating. They knew each other. They were not yet engaged, but your father gave her a way out.
He worked very hard. Pulled as many strings as he was able to pull from Indiana to try to get her released from the camp in order to come to Indiana to get married. Of course, her parents wouldn't be able to come or to leave, but she could get out. And so that's what they were able to do. She worked on it from her end, and he worked on it from his. But it's interesting to remember the cultural situation at that time, because his way of proposing to her in a more formal sense and saying, "Let's do this," was to say, "I think you need to come and live here and leave that camp." And she said later, "I think that's pretty much the way a proposal sounds right now." And so she left. That's when she left the
camp.
That
must have been so hard for her, though.
I mean, it was very difficult. She was very difficult.
She had a brighter future ahead, but to leave her parents, to leave her nieces, her sister still in the hospital with tuberculosis.
She had, she said more than once to me, she said, "The hardest thing I ever had to do was to leave my parents behind in that camp." And she was also leaving the nieces, her nieces, my cousins. And she was torn between the chance to start moving toward a happy life in personal terms and the fact that she was leaving behind people in a very unhappy circumstances.
So at the same time as her parents are incarcerated in this camp, surrounded by razor wire, guard towers with loaded guns, she goes off. She gets married to a man who then is serving his country as a Japanese American, and he goes off to war.
Exactly. And, of course, they were in love. And so they got married, even though at the time he knew that he would be activated into the army. They needed doctors, and that he would be sent off to the war. As it turned out, he was sent off to the war in the European theater.
And we're talking about your family story, but this happened in so many families of people of Japanese descent, where part of the family was incarcerated, and many of the sons were fighting.
That's true. That's true. And they, and many of the sons signed up for the military knowing that this would not necessarily result in the release of their parents, but they were still determined to prove that they were loyal Americans, and they wanted to do, and that they would do whatever it took to serve their country. And so there was a real kind of, I don't know if paradox is the right word, but a paradox at work there, where part of the family was locked up and other members of the family were serving in the military.
You came along shortly after your parents got married. Your dad did get to meet you on a 3-day pass and then went to Europe, so he didn't see you until after the war again. But your mother actually went back to the camp, and she took you with her. So you actually lived in this camp for about 6 months.
I did. And she went back there to help my grandparents take care of my cousins, and then to help, in effect, help my aunt work out what she could, having to do with a failing marriage. And so she took me with her, and then that was the first time I got to meet my grandparents.
How old were you when you learned that you had actually lived in one of these internment camps?
Well, I was still a boy. But it didn't register, if you can understand it. It didn't register what that meant, because I was young enough not to have absorbed the experience at the time. And I was 9 months to a year and a half, something like that. And so camp was a kind of a word and a concept, but not an experience in the way it was for many other people. And then as I grew older and camp was referred to again and again, I realized that there was something there that I needed to understand a lot better.
In the very beginning of the book, you write about a telephone conversation you had in 1987. And,
yes.
And this is after you had written a letter to the editor, to the Des Moines Register, and this was at a time, 1987, when Japanese Americans were still petitioning to get some sort of acknowledgement and a little bit of a payback for what they had been put through.
Yes, and I'd written a letter just supporting the legislation and urging people to support it as it went through the Congress. And I got a cold call one evening from a fellow from Boone, who was a World War II veteran and who, in fact, had been a prisoner of the Japanese in the Pacific. And he was against the bill that was going through the Congress at the time. And he wanted to tell me why. And, of course, it had a lot to do with the fact that he had been a prisoner of war, had suffered under the Japanese, and he couldn't separate the Japanese that he had fought against and who had imprisoned him with the Japanese Americans. He said, well, they're all Japanese. And I tried to explain to him the difference. And the more we talked, the more it was clear to me that he had his own painful experience that he was trying to talk his way through, and just as I had. And so we just sort of talked, and then we'd listen to each other and we'd talk. And it was a remarkable conversation. And it was one of the triggers for me to write the book, finish the book, tell the story, and hopefully have an audience that would learn something about the experience of my family, and in reading the book, understand how it was for me to put the story together.
We're losing our World War II veterans rapidly. This is a generation that is passing. But obviously for many of them, it would be difficult to really sort out their feelings about the Japanese who they fought during the war.
Exactly.
But then for those of us who have never had an experience like that, reading about this and in even thinking about the fact that there were internment camps, but also trying to understand the discriminatory laws in this country and how long it took for the United States government to really say, we're sorry.
Yes.
It is so hard to wrap one's mind around. I mean, do you think that this is something that can be put behind us?
Well, I think it can if we understand it. If we understand that this kind of thing can happen and did happen, and if we understand why, how it could have happened, and if we read the historical record, we can see that it didn't have to happen, but various individuals brought it about without much resistance from a lot of other individuals. And I think there's some important lessons there regarding how we conduct ourselves under duress, as opposed to when there's nothing, no immediate issue or nothing immediately at risk, and we can operate in terms of platitudes and habit. So I think it's important to understand that it did happen, and it could happen again if we're not vigilant. And all of the things that militated against or that created a negative environment for Japanese Americans, those kinds of things can occur again or can be put into motion again if we're not careful.
Neil, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Neil Nakadati is the author of Looking After Minidoka, an American memoir. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Jason Burns. You can get in touch with us anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Pardon me. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the extinction of the passenger pigeon, and we'll visit with some modern pigeons who can teach us a lot. This is Talk of Iowa.